This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. It's been revealed the Australian Federal Police was told 5 years ago about a potential leak of confidential Commonwealth tax information by consultancy giant PwC. Tax officials have told a Senate hearing they first became suspicious even earlier than that. But when they alerted the AFP in 2018, an investigation never got off the ground due to insufficient information. However, the AFP is now investigating. Here's political reporter Noor Haider.
In the months since the PwC tax leak scandal first erupted, there's been a steady drip feed of revelations about what took place and who knew about it. Last night, Australian Tax Office Commissioner Chris Jordan told a Senate estimates hearing that the ATO first realised something was amiss 7 years ago.
In January 2016, we became aware of a handful of multinationals suspiciously and quickly attempting to restructure their affairs upon the introduction of the multinational anti-avoidance law.
The ATO began investigating tax schemes by the Big Four consultancy firms, eventually obtaining internal PwC emails despite attempts by the firm to avoid handing over information by claiming legal privilege.
It appeared our investigation was being frustrated through false LPP claims.
The emails hinted at a potential breach of confidentiality by PwC partner Peter John Collins, who'd been involved in consultations with Treasury on tax since 2013. Concerned by what they'd uncovered, the ATO put together a dedicated team to further investigate. Here's ATO Second Commissioner Jeremy Hirshon.
20 or so staff were solely focused on dealing with these matters.
He said that in 2018, the ATO shared some of what it had discovered with the Australian Federal Police.
We were horrified when we came across it. Our path was to first explore with the Federal Police the information that we had.
But that path hit a dead end, as Commissioner Chris Jordan explained to Green Senator Barbara Pocock.
Did they initiate an investigation?
No.
Why not?
They felt they didn't have sufficient evidence at that time to pursue that.
Isn't that shocking?
In a statement, an AFP spokesperson said they assessed a set of sample documents provided by the ATO in 2018 and determined that there was insufficient information to proceed and the matter was closed in agreement with the ATO. Mr. Jordan told Senate estimates that due to strict tax secrecy laws, the ATO could not raise its concerns about PwC with the federal government.
We are not allowed to share protected information with ministers.
He described the secrecy provisions as very restrictive and questioned whether changes were required.
But I think it could be, in hindsight here, looking at what's happened, a better ability to share, say, with Treasury.
The secrecy laws are being reviewed by the Attorney General's Department with a report due at the end of next month. The Tax Practitioners Board will appear before Senate estimates today.
Noor Haider reporting. The AFL says an independent panel investigation into alleged racism at the Hawthorn Football Club has wound up, making no adverse findings against its former coaching staff. The AFL was rocked in September last year when First Nations former players and their families alleged mistreatment. The club and staff have always strenuously denied any wrongdoing, but as Angus Randall reports, this may not be the end of the saga.
A four-page statement has just been released by the AFL and a press conference is coming in.
After 8 months of uncertainty, late last night, the AFL brings the investigation into alleged racism at Hawthorn to an end. Gillon McLachlan is the outgoing AFL CEO.
No adverse findings have been made in the independent investigation against any of the individuals against whom allegations have been made. The complainants wish to resolve all differences with the AFL. As a result of this agreement, the complainants do not wish to pursue the independent panel investigation, which they wholeheartedly supported.
Former coaches Alistair Clarkson and Chris Fagan and ex-welfare manager Jason Burt have always strenuously denied claims they mistreated First Nations players and their families. With the investigation coming to a close, Gillon McLachlan says none of them will face any charges under AFL rules.
This is an imperfect resolution, and I want to reiterate that the way this report emerged, it has led to being a period of high distress for all parties, and sure, it was always going to be difficult to find an outcome.
Not all the ex-Hawthorn players and their families who'd alleged racism took place were cooperating with the independent panel, and there's still the prospect some may consider civil action or could take their case to the Australian Human Rights Commission. The AFL says there's been no financial component to the agreement reached with the complainants that were part of the investigation.
The AFL acknowledges each one of the complainants feels hurt, pain and anguish following their time at Hawthorn.
Both the coaches and Hawthorn families have previously confirmed they were not formally interviewed by the independent panel. Earlier this month, Alistair Clarkson took indefinite leave from his new club, North Melbourne, to focus on his well-being. Chris Fagan is now the head coach at Brisbane. In a statement, he says he's been vindicated, calling the process a travesty of justice that has caused him tremendous hurt. Hawthorn has also welcomed the decision to close the investigation and has acknowledged the significant emotional toll it's taken on all involved. Gillon McLachlan says it's been one of the most challenging times for the AFL.
The AFL wishes to reiterate and acknowledge the significant emotional toll it's taken on everyone affected by this complex and delicate situation. Those who told their stories and those who stood accused. And the public nature of how it has played out since late September last year.
The Hawthorn Football Club could still face charges of misconduct or bringing the game into disrepute.
Angus Randall reporting there. There are new details about the precarious state of Australia's construction industry, with the corporate watchdog ASIC revealing an average of 5 companies are collapsing every day. First home buyers are losing their life savings and thousands of projects are at a standstill at a time when there's a chronic housing shortage. Here's National Regional Affairs reporter Jane Norman.
First home buyer David Niblett despairs as he stands on the patchy grass in front of his half-built house in Teesdale near Geelong. The foundation is there and the roof is on, but inside it's nothing but plywood and concrete slabs.
Yeah, just what every Aussie's trying to do, build your first home, and it's just been an absolute nightmare.
He was so close to being a proud owner. But 2 years after signing a fixed-price contract with Porter Davis, the builder collapsed. He can make a claim with Victoria's building insurer to recoup some of his money, but it won't cover the extra costs he's now facing to finish his family home.
So I've had real estates go out there and sort of evaluate if we can sell the property as a half-finished house, and sort of hopefully might be able to sort of sell it and be out of debt. If not, I've even considered maybe just claiming bankruptcy.
The corporate watchdog ASIC says more than 1,700 builders have gone broke so far this financial year, already eclipsing the total number of insolvencies in the sector in the previous financial year. And it's creating a choke point as demand outstrips supply. Nursing student Lemlem migrated to Australia from Ethiopia. She was so determined to save for her first home, she paused her studies to work as a full-time carer.
I was working like almost day and night to save the money.
She managed to put $15,000 towards a house and land package in Melbourne's outer suburbs, only to learn months later that her builder Privium had collapsed. Unlike the Niblets, Lemlem has no access to insurance.
I had a plan to build my house and then to go back to study. But now I'm just working. Yeah, it's very stressful and very sad.
Many builders have been stung by fixed price contracts they signed during the pandemic, just as inflation rose, sending material and labour costs soaring. Jocelyn Martin from the Housing Industry Association says policies like Home Builder also helped fuel demand.
That has put an enormous amount of pressure, particularly the volume builders did take on a lot of work. We think that we're at the tail end of that now, and as the effects of home builder fall away, that pressure is coming off the industry.
In the meantime, would-be buyers are being advised to get a lawyer to check their contract, research their builder, and ask lots of questions.
The consumer needs to make sure that the builder has the right insurance in place, you know, making sure that once the contract is signed and the project is underway, that the consumer is protected.
Jocelyn Martin from the Housing Industry Association, ending that report from Jane Norman. More than 3 years since the COVID pandemic triggered an exodus from our biggest cities, the lure of regional Australia is showing no signs of fading. New analysis has found Sydney and Melbourne are losing the most residents to the regions, and people are moving further away from the capitals than ever before. And it's the job and business opportunities that are proving the biggest draw card, as Gavin Coote reports.
It might be more than 1,300 kilometres from the state capital, but Townsville in North Queensland has become the highest growth regional area.
Townsville's certainly on the map, and it is a beautiful city to live in and raise a family.
Karen Voverden is a local real estate agent who's been swamped with inquiries from people looking to leave the bigger cities, with the availability of jobs one of the biggest lures for those living in Brisbane or even Sydney and Melbourne.
Victoria is one of the main buyers, I think, still in the group that are looking, and there's still plenty of work around, plenty of work.
What kind of work are they going into when they move to Townsville? Are they taking their jobs with them and doing it remotely, or are they moving altogether into local employment?
Look, a bit of both. We've got some great employers up here. We've got the Army, which is one of the biggest employers. The hospital is still very big. The university is great, James Cook University. But we're still finding that, you know, manufacturing is massive in Townsville. And I think the opportunity to be able to work from home is still strong for a lot of people. So why not do it in a beautiful city like Townsville?
An analysis by the Regional Australia Institute and Commonwealth Bank has found mobility across the country is at its highest in more than 5 years. And the Institute's chief economist, Kim Horton, says many people are moving between regions.
And one of the really fascinating things for me as a bit of a number nerd over the last 3 years is we've seen those high growth places have been moving further and further inland. So we are now seeing quite regional South Australia as seeing the biggest growth rates in the sort of net flows of people from all other parts of Australia.
And while job opportunities are fueling some of the growth, he says many new regional residents are still doing their city jobs remotely.
We have a near record number of job vacancies in regional Australia still. The absolute record was October last year at 94,000. We're still sitting on over 88,000 jobs vacant in regional Australia. And a lot of those jobs are high skilled jobs. They're trades, professions, managerial jobs.
Nevertheless, Kim Horton thinks the exodus from the nation's two biggest cities isn't going to slow down anytime soon.
A lot of people don't realise that Sydney has been a net loser of people to other parts of Australia for about the last 20 years. And the number of people that Sydney is losing is actually going up. So people come to Sydney, people leave Sydney, but the gap is very large. There's many more people leaving Sydney for other parts of Australia than coming to Sydney from other parts of Australia. That net flow out is so large that Sydney alone accounts for about 90% of all the relocations out of cities in Australia. It really is hemorrhaging people to quite a significant degree to other parts of the country. And interestingly, in this last quarter, those Sydney folks are not going as much to regional New South Wales. They're starting to go much more to regional Queensland and regional Victoria. So, you know, the only things that's driving population growth in Melbourne and Sydney are overseas migrants.
Dr. Kim Horton from the Regional Australia Institute, ending Gavin Coote's report. There's been plenty of criticism in recent years about how foster care systems are failing to protect vulnerable children. But there's a small program running in New South Wales that's trying to change that. It involves psychologists and other therapeutic experts leaving their usual jobs to become paid foster parents, as Annie Guest explains.
Leroy Tibalara drops anchor in a tranquil Brunswick River in northern New South Wales, where the serenity is in stark contrast to his early life.
Growing up, I was removed. I have three sisters. We were removed from our family, so put into foster care. And I've been, like, with countless, I really cannot remember how many, like, different foster homes and placements. So bounced around a lot with that.
Even kinship care didn't work out, so at the age of 9, he was placed in a group home.
I was very troubled. I was very troubled and I wasn't easy.
Hey, do you want to get the winch and I'll bring the boat in?
Yeah.
Legend.
Brett Peter was a staff member. They formed a bond and Brett and his wife applied to become Leroy's foster parents.
Relationship is the foundation of all, you know, trust. Trust lies there, healing lies there, that that you've got someone in your life that's there for you no matter what.
Brett Peter is trained to be what's known as a trauma-informed professional. Since Leroy, he's been a foster dad to two more children through a system known as professional individualised care. That's where a psychologist or other therapeutic expert is paid $100,000 a year to leave their day job and become a foster parent, but only for certain kids.
They've all got to a point where they're not looking at foster care placements anymore. Yeah, pretty dire, you know, by the time the last two boys I had, one was 3 years motel, the other one was 2 years of motel rooms.
He says the boys had been costing the state more than $1 million a year each in motels, mental health care and other support. But since moving to Brett's care, one has reunited with his mum and the other...
So the eldest one, he's now 18, he was working full-time for a long time.
The professional individualised care model has operated in Germany for decades, and independent research shows it has more success in keeping children in stable placements than other foster care. Here in Australia, a small program operates in New South Wales. It has the support of Create Foundation, which represents children and young people in out-of-home care. Joseph McDowell is the foundation's director of research.
It's probably the ideal model. The results are incredibly effective.
That's Joseph McDowell from Create Foundation ending Annie Guest's report. You can see more on 7:30 on ABC TV tonight. Women in South Korea are urging the government to introduce more family-friendly policies so they can have a career and children if they wish. The country has the world's lowest birth rate, a record it keeps breaking. North Asia correspondent James Oden reports from Seoul.
Mother of one, Kim Se-hee, has to rush home from work to grab her five-year-old daughter from daycare. Her husband is stuck working long hours at the office, so the evening routine falls on her.
I have to work, do the housework. I have to not just take care of my daughter, I also have to play with her. It's hard because I, as a mother, have to take on more of these things.
For now, it's tough but manageable. However, Se-hee worries she'll have to give up her job as the demands at home increase.
When I went back to work, the idea of having a second child completely disappeared.
Se-hee's story serves as a cautionary tale for younger women in a country where having a successful career and having children is often seen as incompatible. The birth rate has plummeted to 0.78 per woman. In Australia, it's more than double that, 1.70. University student Song Yong-jong is studying to be an interior architect. She's already decided she won't have kids due to Korea's demanding work culture.
There's a culture that makes you feel you have no choice but to overwork. At a company where I interned, I had to work overtime to meet my demanding deadlines. If I had children, I would have to take a break from work. I'm worried about having that career break.
It's a problem South Korean men don't face. Only 4% of men eligible for paternal leave take it. South Korea also has the largest gender pay disparity in the OECD, around 30%, and it has some of the longest working hours. The government this year received huge backlash from Gen Z and millennials when it proposed a 69-hour work week. The idea was you could bank the overtime to spend with family later. The government says it's now looking at a new direction. Former Minister for Women's Equality, Chung Hyung-bak, says female job security is vital to increase the birth rate.
Women no longer agree with the distinction between men at work and women at home. And women think that they should participate in society and work, so they choose work rather than marry and have children.
With the country's population now officially in decline, there's more pressure than ever to fix the problem. This is James Oten in Seoul reporting for AM.
And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The trade war with China cost exporters here billions, but the rift may have also opened Australia up to a new investment boom. Today, the ABC's business editor, Ian Verinder, on the end of the iron ore era as the world goes green. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.